A quick word from our sponsor, Freed. If you're looking to streamline your workflow, Freed is an AI scribe designed to help you do just that. Freed will listen, transcribe, and draft your note, all the while being fully HIPAA compliant. I've been using Freed regularly on my shifts, and I do have to say it is really user-friendly. It seamlessly integrates into my workflow on the phone and on the computer. I've also really appreciated how it really adapts to my style of note writing. I think we all have our unique ways we like our notes to be. For what it's worth, I think it can be a huge game changer in making all our days feel a bit more manageable. And you can also use the code CORE50 to get $50 off your first month of Freed. Again, that's CORE50 for $50 off your first month of Freed. So give it a try and see how an AI scribe can make a difference in your day. And with that, let's get into the episode.
Knowledge is power. Everybody needs to know what their lipoprotein A level is, including both of you. And if you don't know what your lipoprotein A level is, find out. You might get a big surprise. And knowing that you have a risk factor is important.
Welcome to the CORAM 5 Pearls podcast, bringing you high-yield, evidence-based pearls. I'm Dr. Sherry Trivedi, and I'm joined by
Dr. Ian Kelly, a resident at BIDMC.
Today, we are talking all things LP little a.
You know, Shreya, when I first read about Lp(a), I never knew how it was pronounced. I cycled through a mumbled lipoprotein level A or just lipoprotein A under my breath until starting an interview for this episode and mercifully being informed by our first expert that it was in fact known as Lp(a).
It is so humbling. It is not intuitive when you read it, so I definitely was there with you. All right, before we get started, let's take a moment and challenge yourself on the following questions. Remember, the more you test yourself, the deeper your learning gains.
Pearl 1, the uniqueness of Lp(a).
What makes Lp(a) different from other LDL particles, and how does Lp(a) raise ASCVD risk?
Pearl 2, testing.
Which patients should receive Lp(a) testing? And is there any utility in trending levels over time?
Pearl 3, understanding levels.
How do you interpret an Lp(a) level?
Pearl 4, management.
How does an elevated Lp(a) change your management, and when do you consider starting statins?
Pearl 5, potential roles for aspirin and PCSK9 inhibitors.
Is there a role for aspirin in primary prevention for an elevated Lp(a)? What about PCSK9 inhibitors?
So first things first, we sat down with Dr. Coco Fresh, a cardiologist at BIDMC, to figure out exactly what is Lp(a).
It's a subtype of LDL. So LDL is low-density lipoprotein cholesterol C. That's actually distinct from LDL because on its surface, it carries a single molecule of apolipoprotein A and are genetically determined primarily. But this subtype of LDL has an independent role in increasing atherosclerotic cardiovascular risk.
So Lp(a) is basically an LDL particle with this special apolipoprotein A attached.
That's crazy that just a small structural difference compared to the other LDL particles gives it such a significant cardiovascular risk.
Now, it is important to understand that it is unlike LDL or any other lipid particle because it's almost exclusively determined by genetics. And both alleles, that is the allele from each parent, contributes. And so we see that there's a high concordance rate for the disorder amongst first-degree relatives of people who have a high lipoprotein A. About half of first-degree relatives will also have a very high lipoprotein A, and it's associated with a very high risk of coronary artery disease and other atherosclerotic vascular disease events.
That was Dr. Steve Nissen, cardiologist at the Cleveland Clinic. And it turns out that, fascinatingly, this information has been out there for decades. A study from 1981 looked at 76 male post-MI patients and compared their Lp(a) levels to age-matched controls. And what they found was that patients with Lp(a) levels greater than 50 milligrams per deciliter had a 2.3-fold higher risk of heart attacks. And don't worry about numbers for now. We'll get into those later in Pearl 3.
You know, Ian, this does make me wonder, you know, what's so special about Lp(a) that leads to such cardiovascular badness?
Ultimately, I'm not sure, to be completely honest with you, if we fully understand the why. That doesn't mean that we don't have a lot of ideas about what makes that particle more likely to cause atherosclerosis. It's a pro-atherogenic particle. It increases the rate of oxidation, it carries oxidized phospholipids, and so it's pro-oxidative. In order for any lipid particles to cause inflammation when they're inside the artery wall, they need to become oxidized, and Lp(a) increases the rate of oxidation.
That's Dr. Greg Katz, a cardiologist at NYU. So it sounds like Lp(a) will increase oxidation of phospholipids at a much higher rate and therefore worsen that inflammatory milieu inside the plaque.
Yeah. But that like inflammatory milieu business, like that is common across most of the LDL particles, at least to an extent in my memory of the pathophys of these things. So there must be something else going on.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I was surprised to learn that Lp(a) actually increases local thrombosis. So one of the leading thoughts right now is that Lp(a) has structural similarities to plasminogen and may actually compete for binding sites at the endothelium, making things more coagulable at those spots.
Ah, oh, nice. We'll get into all things about why Lp(a) is prothrombogenic and why that matters clinically in Pearl 5.
Yeah, either way, I think the main takeaway for me is that Lp(a) has three main mechanisms proposed for increasing ASCVD risk. It increases oxidation of phospholipids, it's pro-inflammatory, and it's probably thrombogenic.
Yeah. You know, Ian, I think I knew the headline read that Lp(a) carries this independent risk for cardiovascular badness. It's genetically determined. But, you know, I used to get tripped up on Lp(a), and it wasn't until I understood, what is it that Lp(a) tells us, and how is that different from what the conventional lipid panel tells us, that I figured things out more?
Oh, same. And I really had an aha moment after I finally understood how Lp(a) is different from what an LDL-C on a lipid panel or an ApoB is telling us.
A lipid panel tells you the amount of cholesterol that is carried by LDL particles, or LDL-C, and that's different than the number of particles in circulation. I think the simplest way to think about this is we want to think about a traffic problem, and we want to know how many cars are on the road. All of these cars, or all of these vehicles, like LDL is one type of vehicle, Lp(a) is another type of vehicle. There's VLDL, there's IDL, there's a lot of different vehicles on the road.
So LDL-C is the amount of cholesterol carried by LDL particles. In this analogy, maybe that's like LDL-C being the number of people within a particular type of car, like a sedan. So yes, technically the amount of people in the car should correlate with the number of sedans on the road.
Right. And yes, maybe sedans or LDLs are a majority of the problem, but there's also other vehicles that lead to traffic, right? And just like many of these particles, also lead to atherosclerosis. So counting the vehicles directly should be a better estimate than just how many people might be in them. So I guess the question is, how do we find out how many vehicles are actually on the road?
All of those vehicles are marked as vehicles because they have a license plate, and that license plate is apolipoprotein B. And so every single particle that is floating through your bloodstream that has the ability to cause atherosclerotic cardiovascular disease, aka heart disease, every single one of those particles has one apolipoprotein B on it. And because they all have one ApoB, that means that ApoB is a really good metric for the total number of particles that can cause heart disease that are floating through your bloodstream. When you check an ApoB, it doesn't tell you how many of those particles are LDL or how many of those particles are Lp(a) or VLDL. It tells you the total number of vehicles on the road.
Wow, that license plate analogy really hit home. So ApoB is our way to see how many potentially atherosclerotic particles are in circulation in total.
But what if we want to go really looking for those 18-wheelers, right? What about those particles like Lp(a) that might be contributing to atherosclerosis more, right? Might be contributing to more traffic jams, those big trucks, than others.
It does not tell you about the relative contributions of all of those particles. And so if you have a high ApoB, it could all be LDL, and that's what it is for most people. But it could also be you have a pretty normal LDL and you have a lot of Lp(a) floating through your bloodstream. And if that's the case, then your risk is probably a little bit higher. So there's a subset of people who have an apolipoprotein B that looks high and an LDL that looks low. And the term that we use for those patients is they have discordant ApoB and LDL. And when you're discordant, when you have a discordant ApoB and LDL, the ApoB is a better predictor of your heart disease risk. And for some patients, that's because they have a lot of Lp(a).
All right. So getting an Lp(a) in these patients can help us identify those high-risk vehicles that might be contributing more to traffic jams that might not be seen as well or captured in the traditional lipid panel.
I think that's a great point to remember. What I'm taking away is that Lp(a) is one of several atherogenic particles that contributes to ASCVD risk, and Lp(a) is different because it's genetically determined and an independent risk factor for someone's cardiovascular risk. And just to really hammer this home, Lp(a) is pro-inflammatory, carries oxidized phospholipids, and increases their rate of oxidation, and on top of that is procoagulable.
All right. So now that we know that Lp(a) is a type of LDL that has structural properties making it more atherogenic, let's dive into who should we be testing and when to test.
So looking into who to test and different guidelines was really fun to dive into. It turns out that different guidelines and groups have different recommendations, and turns out so did our discussants.
And yes, so first up is Dr. Fresh's approach. It is in line with the American Heart Association guidelines, at least what it is currently. Of course, things can always change. But what I really appreciate is that she broke it down into three memorable buckets about who to test, and it stuck with me.
I'm thinking about patients who have had an event, an MI or a stroke, that maybe not explained by major well-known risk factors or suspected familial hypercholesterolemia. Patients who have sort of recurrent, fitting into the secondary category, again, those sort of recurrent or progressive ASCVD, despite just being really optimally managed.
So the first bucket of people is sending an Lp(a) in those for secondary prevention, right? These are people who've already had a heart attack, a stroke, but don't have those traditional risk factors, or maybe they have a worrisome family history. Or it's going to be those who continue to have cardiovascular events despite doing their best, right? With their LDL, blood pressure, smoking status, all good things.
And one of our reviewers made sure to highlight that testing in those patients that have had an early MI or stroke is super important because elevated Lp(a) is actually the leading cause of heart disease in these patients.
So those are all patients who've had an event, but what about those who haven't had an event?
The second bucket is primary prevention. So those are predominantly the patients who fall into this borderline or intermediate category risk, kind of based on some of our traditional tools, such as the pooled cohort equations. And so when we're looking for a way to better risk stratify our patients who we think are not super, super low risk, then they're in this borderline or intermediate risk, and you're trying to have conversations about risk reduction or understanding risk, Lp(a) can be helpful in that context.
Gotcha. So the second bucket is primary prevention for those who fall into this intermediate or borderline risk category. So maybe around 5-7% on the traditional ASCVD pooled cohort equations, or those in a similar risk profile.
And then last but not least, who falls in that third bucket for getting an Lpa done?
Patients fall into this category if maybe they haven't had a personal history of ASCVD, but perhaps they have a strong family history of premature ASCVD, or they've had a family member who's had very high Lp(a) testing.
And just so we're on the same page, when we talk about premature ASCVD risk, it's going to be a family history in somebody who's less than 55 years old in a person assigned male at birth, and less than 65 years old in someone assigned female.
All right. So now that we have those three buckets in mind, it was really interesting to hear about different practice patterns on who to test and different society recommendations from our other discussants.
Some organizations like the National Lipid Association recommend that every person, every adult, have it tested at least once, preferably early in life, like in their 20s. If you're 25 years old and you find out your lipoprotein A is 350 nanomoles per liter, are you going to do anything differently? Am I going to counsel you to do anything differently during the course of the next few decades of your life? You bet I am.
Wow, testing everybody really makes sense when you think about the prevalence of elevated LP little a.
Really? And how bad is the prevalence numbers?
So most epidemiologic studies report 20 to 25% of people worldwide have elevated LP little a.
20, 25. Wow, that is a ton of patients. You know, I'm guessing also it probably varies based on ethnicities, especially as genetics are at place. I bet there's like clusters in different places in the world.
Yeah, that's such a great point, Shreya. So when I was writing the show notes, I did see that some studies broke down LP little a by different groups and showed that individuals with higher percentage African ancestry and individuals of South Asian descent might actually have higher levels of LP little a.
Yeah, I definitely believe the South Asian descent. I see that way, way too much, unfortunately. So to recap, you know, there are some practitioners who fall in the camp of testing everybody. And then there are some who are more judicious in testing patients who've more had early events, have a significant family history, or recurrent events despite optimal therapy. I think one last thing before we close out the when to test section is thinking about, is there any other influences on the LP little a level? I think I'm always mindful of like, how do we interpret the number? And is there something that could make me making it more variable?
It's a negative acute phase reactant. I think just from my experience, the difference between the value that you get inpatient is not all that different than the value that you get outpatient, because they tend to be pretty similar within 10 or 20%. And so the stuff that you read about it being something that's an unreliable test when somebody is acutely inflamed or acutely sick, that doesn't match what my clinical experience is, which is that it's actually pretty similar. It's more so that it's not influencing anything about your inpatient management.
Yeah. So unfortunately, there aren't a ton of studies looking into the correlation between inpatient and outpatient LP little a levels. Although one thing that was clear is that our discussants and our reviewers echoed that levels change pretty minimally, even with acute illness.
Yeah. I think a good high level takeaway is if you're worried about a patient getting lost to follow up or maybe tough with blood draws or things like that, it may be reasonable just to get the LP little a inpatient, but being mindful that the value can vary a little bit. But if it does come back high, it does give you a heads up that LP little a is at play. All right. And now on to the fun part. You order the LP little a, you get the level back. Now, how do we actually interpret them?
First of all, it's important to understand that unfortunately, about half the world uses one unit system and the other half uses another. Nanomoles per liter is preferred. It's a concentration measure. But in the United States, most institutions use mass units of milligrams per deciliter.
And one mistake I've made when interpreting results is trying to convert someone's lab from nanomoles per liter to milligrams per deciliter.
So we really should not be interchanging measurements between milligrams per deciliters or nanomoles per liter. There's really no interchangeable way to do that because these assays are different. And so we have different cutoffs for the different assays. And so why is that the case? And what do we prefer? We prefer the particle assay, which is the nanomoles per liter, because that measures the total LP little a versus the mass assays, which also include LDL-like particles. And the limitation to this is that LPA particles vary in size.
So basically, not all LP little a particles are created equal. Some people have larger particles, some might be smaller, but the key for the most part seems to be the number of these particles in circulation.
So then what level is normal versus abnormal?
So there's different scales depending on what lab, and the cutoffs are going to be different depending on what your units are. In general, I think that most labs are using 75 milligrams per deciliter as the cutoff between this is really high and this is actually fine.
And of course, different societies use different levels and measurements. But the big takeaway for me was that levels greater than 50 milligrams per deciliter or greater than 125 nanomoles per liter are considered elevated by most of these groups.
But you should think of this, it's a continuous variable, and it's not positive or negative. This is risk relates to the degree of elevation.
If you look at the UK Biobank data, the relative risk is essentially a straight line, almost down to zero. And so it's like LDL. The higher your LDL, the higher your risk. The higher your Lp(a), the higher your risk.
So as Dr. Nishan mentioned, this UK Biobank study looked at about 500,000 patients over a mean follow-up of 11 years.
Nice. 500,000, 11 years. So not too bad, not shabby in terms of trying to see a robust relationship. The caveat here, I think, is this is just from one population, the Europeans.
Yeah. And one point made by our reviewers was that for these patients at extremely high levels, like greater than 100 milligrams per deciliter or greater than 200 nanomoles per liter, they might have an even greater risk than these linear estimates project.
Nice. All right. So this just makes me wonder then, like, how can we leverage, you know, these known risk factors? We already have these like pooled cohort equations and things, and leverage that with someone's Lp(a) number. You know, so how do we reconcile the traditional ASCVD risk calculators and then the genetic piece with an Lp(a) in estimating someone's risk and kind of getting it to be a bit more precise?
Well, you're in luck if you're someone who likes numbers. Basically, you can take your patient's traditional ASCVD risk score and use a multiplier based on the fold increase in their Lp(a) to get someone's new estimate of their 10-year ASCVD risk.
All right, let's apply that in an example to see what that actually all means. Say we have a 65-year-old woman, not smoking, non-diabetic, total cholesterol is 170, HDL is 50, blood pressure rides at like 110s or so. She's on an antihypertensive. This gives us a 5 to 6% risk by the conventional pooled ASCVD risk calculator. Now, just for like dramatic effect and also making it easier for the calculations, let's say she has a really high Lp(a) number, like 500 nanomoles per liter. How do we then get a more accurate estimate on her ASCVD risk?
So the teaching point is that for every 50 nanomole per liter increase in Lp(a), there is a 1.1-fold increase in the hazard ratio for ASCVD event. And then This math is really cool and so informative to calculate out. And don't worry if this goes over your head, although for me, it got a lot more clear when working through an example and trying to work it out by myself. We'll lay out the full equation in the show graphic so that you can review that after going through the example.
So using that hazard ratio of 1.11 and their pooled cohort risk, we'll just say it's 5.5 for math's sake. What we can do is say, okay, so the Lp(a) is 500. We would divide 500 by 50. So we said, remember, for those increments of the nanomole increments of increased linear risk for ASCVD. So 500 divided by 50 is easy, 10. So if we did 1.11, that hazard ratio, to the 10th power, we would get something like 2.8. If you then multiplied that by their pooled cohort risk of 5.5, so 2.8 times 5.5, you would get something like 15.4 doing the math. The way you can think about that and help have this help guide your discussions about risk modification is that that patient who originally had a pooled cohort equation risk of 5.5%, you're now talking to them as related to a risk of 15%.
Boy, I cannot wait until someone puts that into MDCalc or some other calculator out there.
Yeah. Oh, that would be so great. But maybe the reason why we don't have an easy website calculator for this yet is we still need further validation and exploration of this relationship between Lp(a) and ASCVD. And this equation should really be used for a rough estimate at this point and might even break down at extreme levels. So use with caution.
Okay. I appreciate that kind of rough estimate there. All right. So I think big takeaway here is that Lp(a) is a continuous variable, right? The higher it is, the worse the cardiovascular risk. As a rule of thumb, levels greater than 50 milligrams per deciliter or greater than 125 nanomoles per liter are considered elevated by most societies. And yes, there is an equation that we'll link to in the graphics that can help us re-estimate ballpark someone's ASCVD risk.
I am so excited to have Shakeology as a sponsor. Like many of you, I'm so busy with all the different hats that we're juggling and want something easy, quick, but also healthy. Set yourself up with a good day with vital nutrients that you get with Shakeology. It's a superfood shake that's really easy to mix with water, or I like it with milk. And honestly, for those days where it gets really busy in the hospital or in between meetings, it really does satisfy me and helps curb any cravings. It's a complete nutrition supplement, so think about getting all your greens, all the antioxidants, really supporting that health, digestion, and energy we all need. Also, it's only got the good stuff, so no added sugar, artificial sweeteners, preservatives, or colors. Shakeology is an all-in-one nutrition shake, and they have a really great deal going on right now. Free shipping, as well as a free shaker cup, plus more discounts. You've got to give these shakes a try. Go to Shakeology.com to get 15% off with the code CORIAM. That's Shakeology.com, code CORIAM, for 15% off. And with that, let's get back to the episode. I am so excited to have Thrive Market as a sponsor for the podcast. I've been trying to eat clean for a while now, and I just don't have the bandwidth to look into all the ingredients and what the clean staples are. And I am so grateful that Thrive is there because it takes away all that guesswork and does the thinking for us. Thrive Market is my go-to online grocery store where I really do get all my healthy essentials delivered to my doorstep. I can just trust that every product meets the highest quality standard. They actually ban like 1,000 harmful ingredients, so I never have to second guess what's in my pantry. And I appreciate that I can just really make easy swaps from sugary snacks that I'm used to grabbing to high quality, gut-friendly ones. Like, for example, I love having Simple Mill crackers on hand, Less for Evil popcorn, things I didn't even know about until looking at Thrive Market. Then there's this easy high protein filter option that makes it really easy to stock up on things like, for example, Primal Kitchen protein pack sauces or things like clean omega-3 rich nuts, seed blends. So if you want to upgrade your health, go to thrivemarket.com/corium for 30% off your first order plus a free $60 gift. That's thrivemarket.com/corium. ThriveMarket.com/Corium. And with that, let's get back into the episode. All right. Now on to what I think is the most important pearl, which is how do we counsel our patients and manage these patients, both at the time point before we get an Lp(a) level and certainly when it comes back high?
I cannot tell you how many my chart messages or how many messages from patients I've gotten on Epic when we do their initial cardiovascular prevention labs. And I check Lp(a) in everybody, but somebody gets a value back and it is 150 and they start Googling and it sends people down not just a rabbit hole of doing research, but it sends them down this incredibly stressful pathway about, am I a ticking time bomb and am I about to die and am I about to have a heart attack?
Yeah, I have definitely had a bunch of friends who've unfortunately had heart attacks in their 40s, despite being like these fitness enthusiasts. And they have also asked me just the same gut-wrenching questions.
I am very much a believer that the first conversation someone has with a doctor about a condition frames for the rest of their life the way they think about that condition. And so, yes, high Lp(a) is a risk factor for heart disease, but it is not the only thing that determines whether or not you're going to have a heart attack. And now that we know about this, if we are really proactive in testing, screening, and treating you for all of the other things that cause heart disease, I fully believe that we're going to totally change the trajectory of your lifelong risk.
So in some ways, checking Lp(a) can be an anxiety trap for patients unless we counsel them ahead of time. But on the other hand, for some patients, knowing this level can be liberating.
There's a lot of people who come in with uncertainty about why their family history looks the way it does. And the interaction between Lp(a) and family history is so profound because for a lot of people, it's an aha moment and it's an explanation of nobody in their family has high cholesterol, nobody in their family has diabetes, nobody in their family smokes, but everybody has heart attacks. It's almost like the peace of mind that people get of, oh, I didn't cause this. This wasn't my fault.
Yeah, I appreciate all that framing for the patient. I'm just going to steal some of those words before sending off an Lp(a) level next. But I'm also curious, you know, say when we see an Lp(a) level in our patients that's high, how does that change how we frame things for us as clinicians?
I like this prevention 1.5. It's not exactly primary prevention. It's almost that we treat them more akin to secondary prevention because of such high risk, even though they haven't had their event.
Ugh, I love that. Prevention 1.5.
When I see these patients, I take time with them because many of them, they need to understand. And they also need to understand that because although we have investigational treatments that are quite promising, there's no treatment.
No treatment yet. Dr. Nissen and a bunch of other really smart, really dedicated people are working hard on some promising therapeutics. And fortunately, they're not alone. There are multiple treatments at various stages in the pipeline, which Dr. Nissen was happy to teach us about.
I have a very simple and encouraging message. Help is on the way. Trials like the Lp(a) Horizon trial with pelacarsen are going to complete within the next couple of years. We have a high confidence level that they will be successful, although I obviously don't know. And won't know until I'm unblinded. And we are going to then, if the first of the trials are successful, we will do everything we can to get this in front of the FDA for an accelerated approval, for a rapid approval.
So I'll admit, I totally went down the rabbit hole nerding out about these treatments and their mechanisms, which I will spare you from. But we'll plan to release a short supplementary video on YouTube based on our discussions with our discussants for those interested.
All right. Thank you for sparing us, Ian. But yeah, you know, it's great that these treatments are on the way. But I think more practically speaking, you know, at least for right now, how do we manage these patients? You know, how do we approach the counseling and coach them through this?
So let me tell you the most important message that I give to these patients is I say, we can't lower your lipoprotein A, but we can take all your other risk factors off the table. We get your LDL down. Typically, I try to get down below 55 milligrams per deciliter. We get your blood pressure under good control. We make sure you're not overweight. We make sure you exercise, and we try to either prevent or treat diabetes. So all of the conventional risk factors. And what we find is if you really treat the other risk factors well, you can often keep people safe, at least in the short term. And those that have had an event, we can help prevent a recurrent event.
And to hammer this home, because honestly, before this episode, I pretty much looked at Lp(a) level and cardiovascular risk as something you had no control over. But to hammer home the point of taking the other risk factors off the table, we have to think about one of the main drivers of cardiovascular events in the first place. And yes, the pathophys of cardiovascular events is complicated, but one of the main events is endothelial dysfunction and damage, right? And this brings us back to thinking about what actually causes that endothelial damage.
The damaged endothelium is not something that the lipoprotein is doing. And that's going to be caused by hypertension, by tobacco or other particulate matter, by age-related changes. But the endothelial damage increases the permeability to those proteins with cholesterol in them that are going to increase the risk of cardiovascular disease.
So yes, knowledge is power. If Lp(a) is playing a factor for our patient, which apparently it is for maybe up to 20% of our patients, depending on where we are in terms of prevalence, then yes, let's aggressively try to minimize all the things that can cause endothelial damage.
A high Lp(a) might make me escalate the dose of statin or add on ezetimibe to get the LDL closer to 55. It might make me more likely to treat a blood pressure that's consistently 133 systolic instead of letting it ride. It may make me spend 5 extra minutes talking to the patient about smoking cessation and their common triggers and what they like about smoking. It does influence the 55-year-old who's had an LDL of 130 for 10 years and it's starting to creep up. And it makes me push the lipid-lowering discussion a little bit more aggressively. It makes my recommendation go from, I think this is a reasonable thing to do, to this is what I would do if I were sitting where you are. And so it changes the tone of my recommendations, and it changes the confidence with which I deliver them. And so I'm using LPA as like a tiebreaker more than I'm using it as an arbiter of, do we do this or do we not do this?
You know, this got me thinking, just to ask explicitly, how should we be thinking about lipid goals for these patients with a LPA level or family history? You know, do they have different LDL goals?
Well, it turns out this is a bit of a gray zone, and management is really going to be tailored to the patient in front of you. And people really have different practice patterns, which we learned from our discussants.
If their LPA is greater than about 70 milligrams per deciliter, or maybe 125 to 150 nanomoles per liter, at those levels, I think very aggressive treatment of their LDL and other risk factors is warranted. If you're in that borderline area, you've got a lipoprotein A of 40 milligrams per deciliter or 80 nanomoles per liter, it all depends on other factors. I tend to put almost all of them on a statin, unless their LDL is 40 or something like that. If you look at the PCSK9 inhibitor trials, we treated people to LDLs as low as 30 milligrams per deciliter median, and we got benefits. So I treat these people almost uniformly with a statin because I think it's the right thing to do. And I think the guidelines just need to catch up.
Okay. Maybe the takeaway is to get these patients' LDL as low as possible, unless they're already coming in with an LDL as low as 40 or something. But say we chart review the patient and they've already had an LPA done a few years ago. And this was really motivational for them to change a lot of things in terms of their lifestyle. I'm curious because, you know, I'm a sucker for trending things, and also people want to know if their lifestyle changes were effective. You know, do we test again? Should we get another level after now it's been a few years?
Once you've obtained a level, there is no reason to repeat it in the absence of some therapy because it doesn't change. Remember that it's not affected by lifestyle or anything else. You know, if you're at 180 nanomoles per liter when you're 25, that's what you're going to be when you're 45 or 65.
Yeah, and this really reinforces that LPA levels are not significantly affected by anything aside from genetics. And to add to that, I was reading that levels stay static after about age 5.
Wow.
And so one of the most important questions I ask patients when I see them with a high lipoprotein A is, do you have any children? Do you have any siblings? Are your parents still alive? And I recommend that all of those people be tested. And you would be surprised how often it comes back that the family, many people in the family have the disorder, and many of them have had atherosclerotic vascular disease events.
Okay. So that being said, I'm curious, you know, do these patients automatically warrant like a referral to cardiology?
Not necessarily. It's not like a cardiologist is not doing anything magical for a patient like this. I'm always happy to see those patients, but I do not think that there is something magic about LPA that only a cardiologist is able to treat and take care of.
Appreciate that empowerment. You know, one thing I've heard is that LPA, when you're on statins, can actually raise the LPA level. Is that true? Like, I imagine a patient might start freaking out that their LPA level actually went up after a statin, God forbid if they were to get it checked again.
There is a lot of data that statins will raise your levels of LPA by somewhere along the lines of 10 to 20%. Just because statins raise LPA does not mean that they are bad for patients who have high LPA. Statins are risk-reducing medications, and the benefit that you get is really kind of like irrespective of whether or not your LPA is elevated. And so a high LPA or a rise in LPA after starting statin therapy is not a reason to stop a statin. Statins are still risk-reducing medications for those patients.
It's definitely good to know that for patients with elevated LPA and high LDL levels with already high ASCVD risks, that rise in LPA should not factor into decision-making for starting these medications and is really offset by the cardioprotective effects that statins provide.
All right. And then last thing, say our patient already had a cardiovascular event, just to say it out loud, how do we then manage an elevated LPA level?
If somebody is coming in for secondary prevention, meaning they have had a heart attack or they have had a stroke, then I am going to try to optimize every single risk factor that I have the ability to optimize. And so somebody has high Lp(a) and they have an acute MI, I'm going to try to get their LDL down to 40. If somebody has low Lp(a) and they have an acute MI, I'm probably still going to try to get their LDL down to 40. And it goes the same for blood pressure.
These are the people that, you know, yes, it's shared decision making, but when I talk with them, I say, you really do need to deal with these risk factors. If you have a high lipoprotein A and you have poorly treated diabetes, or you have hypertension not well controlled, you're just asking for trouble.
All right, so to summarize, we've established that Lp(a) can be something that tips the scales for a more aggressive lifestyle and LDL-lowering therapies in these patients. Then this is especially true in our patients for primary prevention in that more intermediate risk group. And then it also pushes us to, of course, be even more aggressive in patients who've already had an event when managing them for secondary prevention. You know, I was thinking back to earlier in the episode, we were talking about Lp(a) and some of the ways it's unique in that it's prothrombogenic. So I'm curious, how does that hypercoagulability piece play a role in terms of our management?
The thing that I personally find most interesting about Lp(a) is the prothrombotic or hypercoagulable aspect of it. And one of the sort of teleologic or evolutionary explanations of why we have Lp(a) at all is that it might have been protective against trauma because of its prothrombotic nature. So evolution may have selected for actually high Lp(a) because it doesn't cause problems until we're way past reproductive age. And it may have a survival advantage early on in the prothrombotic nature of how that particle works. And that has to do with the structural homology of something called these Kringle repeats to plasmin.
All right, so if Lp(a) is structurally similar to plasmin, competes with plasminogen, then there's going to be less plasminogen to be converted to local plasmin, and that means less fibrinolysis.
Yeah, so overall, less local fibrinolysis means more clotting in regions where Lp(a) is binding to exposed or damaged endothelium, which means potentially higher risk of MI or stroke.
All right. So this gets me thinking, if it is prothrombogenic, I know aspirin for primary prevention is like a loaded topic, but I'm curious, if it is prothrombogenic, is there any role for aspirin here?
We don't have very good data. We have some data from some of the aspirin trials that does suggest a benefit of aspirin in primary prevention in people with a high lipoprotein A. It's not very good data. You know, it wasn't primarily what they were investigating.
So the data right now comes from retrospective analysis of large studies where aspirin for primary prevention in these patients with elevated Lp(a) was not the original hypothesis, right? And we have all learned that then that means it's definitely under the umbrella of hypothesis generating.
Yeah, and one of our reviewers took this point even further and pointed out that in some of these studies, this benefit only applied to a subgroup of patients with a specific Lp(a) mutation instead of measuring Lp(a) levels directly.
That being said, because lipoprotein A is both proatherogenic and prothrombotic, I treat many of these people with low-dose aspirin, and I treat almost nobody else in primary prevention with low-dose aspirin, but these people I make an exception.
The question of aspirin for primary prevention in Lp(a) it's so important, and we just don't know. I think that for my patients who have high Lp(a), and when I say high Lp(a), I'm generally thinking a value over 75 with any family history of heart attack or stroke, I'm generally saying aspirin is pretty reasonable.
Okay, now switching gears. Last thing, I think we'd be remiss if we did not talk about the cool kids on the block for lipid lowering, PCSK9 inhibitors. Where do they fall in terms of treatment of Lp(a)?
Yeah, so I read into the Fourier trial and some of the other analyses off of that. And in that, we saw that evolocumab lowered Lp(a) levels, which was shocking to me, given that this just doesn't seem to be talked about.
Yeah, wait, hold on. I thought you just told me that there was no treatment for Lp(a). Like, lies? Should we be starting PCSK9 inhibitors in these patients?
I don't. And I'm going to tell you why. If you look at some of the data, the people that got the biggest reduction in lipoprotein A were people that had kind of mid-range, low to mid-range lipoprotein A levels. Those in the top quartile got 16 milligram per deciliter reduction in lipoprotein A. It's not very much. And you've got a therapy that's expensive, requires self-injection every couple of weeks, has no substantial data suggesting a benefit. So I don't do it. Now, there are other practitioners who do, and I don't fault them for it. I just look at the data and say, it's not good enough.
Ooh, sounds like I should pump the brakes a little bit on excitement for PCSK9 inhibitors.
Yeah. And of course, I think the unexpected theme of our episode is that everyone has a little bit of different practice patterns. And I think this is especially true when we find ourselves with patients who maybe haven't tolerated a statin as well or ezetimibe as well.
I do not make a decision to use a PCSK9 inhibitor because it lowers Lp(a). I use a PCSK9 inhibitor because it lowers my total atherogenic particle number. It lowers my LDL. It lowers my ApoB. And so I'm using it as a risk-reducing medication and using that as my metric of success, not what happens to that Lp(a).
So to recap these last two pearls, aspirin has theoretical use for primary prevention for elevated Lp(a) based on physiology and some retrospective reviews. But we need more data in the form of prospective trials going forward before we can definitively say if it's protective or not in these patients.
Right. And then for PCSK9 inhibitors, yes. PCSK9 inhibitors do lower Lp(a) levels, but not enough to get them down to a clinically significant lower risk bracket. But yes, you can certainly use them to lower the total atherogenic particles if there is trouble getting them to the LDL goals you want. And with that, that is a wrap for this episode. If you found this episode helpful, please, please, please share it with one of your teammates, one of your colleagues, a friend who could use this. Give it a rating on Apple Podcasts or whatever podcast app you use. It really does help people find us.
And thanks to all of our reviewers for this podcast. Thank you to Jerome Reyes for the audio editing and Dr. Jesse Powell for the accompanying graphics. This episode was made as part of the Digital Education Tract at BIDMC.
Opinions expressed are our own and do not represent the opinions of any affiliated institutions. Thank you. Take care.